Please stand by. Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's IBM IM Technical Deep Dive Series conference call. The topic for today is Security Compliance, Label-Based Access Control, Roles, Viper 2 Enhancements. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the call over to Mr. Thabo Bhopati. Please go ahead, sir.
All right. Thank you, Marjorie, and good morning, everyone, wherever you are. And today's conference is based on label-based access control, and today's presenter is our lead, Rajaivi. And at this moment, I'll turn over to him, and he can continue with the talk. I do have a short screen that I'm sharing with you to see if everybody else is on the web dialogues. If you see a little poll going on, that's me. Everybody see my screen? Walid, can you see my screen?
I see a screen. It's dark at this point.
Oh, okay. All right, I'm going to turn it over to you now. Hold on.
Okay, I see the first chart.
All right. Okay, you should have control now, Walid.
Okay, so just one moment.
Yeah, I see the second screen.
Okay, cool. Okay. I'm ready anytime you want me to start.
Yeah, sure, you can go ahead.
Okay, good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, depending on where you are. So this presentation is going to touch on the three security pillars and databases, namely access control, encryption, and auditing. I'm moving to the second chart. So that's the agenda for today. I probably won't spend too much time on the first point because I'm assuming if you guys are here, you already understand the importance of database security. And then we'll get into access control, encryption in transit and in storage, and auditing. Okay, so very briefly, if you look at the history of information security, you would realize that initially and for about, 20 years or so, there was a strong focus on network security and on host security and on physical security, but very, very small focus has been given to database security. And there are a variety of reasons for that, and I think primarily the primary reason was that security people were not database people, and database people were not necessarily security people. So it took really some time for those two things to get together. And also there was a strong focus on database security, particularly after people were able to very easily get information from the database, like all the SQL injections attacks that you have heard about, etc. And so basically people realize that at the end of the day, the data really resides inside the database. And if you don't take steps to make sure that the database is properly secured, then your information is vulnerable. Okay, so this chart, basically what I'm trying to say in this chart, I think you probably have seen it, but the key point here is that, the people who might want to steal your data are not necessarily, teenage hackers, trying to access your system. They can be professional hackers. They can be people, doing this for money. And there could be also insiders. In fact, if you look at the FBI crime survey on information security, or actually on computer crime, for the last 4 or 5 years, we will realize that every year the indication is that the financial losses that come from the insiders abusing their privileges is much higher than penetrations from outsiders. So this is, again, making sure that your database is properly configured and secured is very important. Uh, There are also, and this is something that, you know, you probably have been hearing for the last 3 or 4 years, regulatory compliance. And this is really a buzzword, and I hear people using it, and often it's confusing to many customers because people will use this buzzword, and you know, at the end of the day, people still don't understand what they are supposed to do. This is being said, I'll get to that in the next chart, but there are regulations that exist, you know, in many countries in North America, but in Europe, in Japan, and many other countries as well. Some of the most famous of them are the payment card industry, PCI, SOX, HIPAA, GLB, and Basel II. And there are also, best practices that, you know, often some large corporations such as ours, for example, you know, they have best practices for with respect to data security, and you want to make sure that those best practices are actually followed when it comes to implementing your database security. This is really the key message. If you would like you guys to get one key message out of this presentation, is this one. I will be later on talking about technical features, but you can get those, you know, in the books as well. But this is really, really the message that I'd like to communicate, and I'd like to make sure that you guys get this message. When you hear the term regulatory compliance, there is really no magic silver bullet that, you know, you can buy something and suddenly you are compliant. The key message that I'd like to point out here is that at the end of the day, no matter what the solution is, no matter who's the vendor for that solution, whether it's IBM or something else, at the end of the day, to be really compliant with whatever standards or whatever regulations, at the end of the day, it's going to boil down to the three pillars of data security. You need to have some sort of access control in place. You need to have some sort of encryption in place, and you need to have some sort of auditing in place. These are the three pillars of database security or even information security for that matter, and there is no way you can build a solution that does not have these three components as essential component of that solution, no matter who the vendor is. So this is really key, because I have seen, you know, the term regulatory compliance being used, you know, as a buzzword, and at the end of the day, people still don't understand what that is. Whatever the solution is going to boil down to contain these three essential components. I don't see how you could be compliant with anything without having these three components. So it's very important to understand the capability that DB2 offers in this area, so that, you know, when you're talking to your customers and, you know, suggesting solutions, you should be able to recommend them based on these three pillars, basically. Okay, having said that, so the first pillar of data security or database security is access control. And DB2 has a variety of capabilities that allow you to implement access control. And the first measure of access control is what we refer to as authentication. So authentication is there to be able to validate the user. So if Bob comes and says, "I'm Bob," we need to make sure that, you know, we need to challenge him and ask him to prove that he is indeed Bob. And DB2 can be configured to support the three main authentication options. So you could configure DB2 such as your users are authenticated using the operating system, the box on which DB2 is installed. If your users are defined there, then you could simply configure DB2 to do the authentication there. In many organizations today, we noted that there is a trend towards centralization, having users and their group membership defined in an LDAP directory, such as our own Tivoli directory server or the Microsoft Active Directory or SUN1 directory server. So DB2 could also be configured to authenticate users that are defined in an LDAP directory and also acquire their group membership from that same LDAP directory. There is also some customers also use Kerberos, and the advantage of Kerberos is single sign-on. So if you have signed, if you have authenticated yourself to a machine on a network that uses Kerberos, and your DB2 client and your DB2 server on that are also on that machine, then you are not going to be challenged again. So we are noticing that Kerberos is not as heavily used as LDAP or the operating system, but there are some customers out there that use it. There is, for historical reason, DB2 allows you to configure it such that the authentication is performed at the client. I will never recommend such an option to any customer. So I'm just listing it there for historical purpose. But generally, you know, you have three ways of authenticating your users. You have operating system, LDAP, and Kerberos. Now, the second step in access control, now you have come, you said you are Bob, we challenged you, and you proved that you are Bob. Now, you are going to try to, you know, execute some operations, be it some commands, some APIs, some SQL statements. So this is where authorization comes in. And authorization basically says, okay, for whatever you ask me to do, do you have the required privilege to do that operation? And so authorization is basically the process that verifies whether the authenticated user is actually allowed to execute the operation they wanted. And it involves determining the permissions that are available to that particular user. So we look at its domain of permissions, and we look at the privilege requirement for that operation, and we compare. And if your domain of permissions allows you to do that, then the operation is allowed. Otherwise, the operation is rejected. And the permissions available to the user, and this is also important to know, they can come from a variety of sources. They can come from permissions granted to the user directly, such as, you know, grant select on T1 to Bob. They could also come from permission grants to roles in which the user is a member. For example, if you are a member in the role manager and the role manager has update on T1, then you also have update on T1. They could also come from permissions granted to groups in which that user is a member. And finally, they could also be coming from permissions granted to the general public. So it's really important to understand where all these different permissions come from, because there is one fundamental principle in data security, we will come to it later, which is the least privileges. So you have to make sure that you know, users do not accidentally get privileges they are not supposed to get. I always get this question about what's the difference between roles and groups. So conceptually, there is really no difference. They are the same thing. So it's a way of putting a collection of users in one entity, which you may call a group or a role. The difference is in the technicalities. So roles are database objects. They are defined and managed solely by DB2. Groups are defined and managed outside DB2, typically in the operating system, but they could also be in an LDAP server, for example. In most cases, you could do the same with either. There are only some restrictions when it comes to using privileges that a user acquires through groups. And this is when it comes to creating objects such as views, triggers, MQT, packages, and SQL routines. Let me explain a little bit why do we have that restriction for groups. So if you think of a view, simple view, where you say create a view V1 as select star from T1. So today, in order to be able to create that view, DB2 requires that you hold at least select privilege on T1. And DB2 also, after allowing you to create the view, DB2 needs to record the fact that you possess select on T1 as a dependency for the valid existence of that view, meaning that if you happen to lose that select privilege in the future, DB2 will automatically make that view inoperative. In order to maintain or enforce this behavior, DB2 cannot consider a privilege coming from groups. Because if somebody loses their membership in groups, DB2 cannot know about it because they are managed outside the database. For that reason, there are these restrictions that group have and role do not. So aside from these restrictions, roles and groups are the same. So I mentioned the fundamental principle, which we call the least privileged principle. So the idea here is that do not grant users more than what they need to do their job. So this means that you have to look at your data, look at the tables, and determine who, according to the business, who is supposed to have access to those tables, and make sure that you grant it only to the appropriate users. Granting privileges to public is generally a bad idea unless you really know what you are doing, because basically when you grant it to public, it means that every user in the system today has access to it, and every user that will come tomorrow or next week or next month or next year will also have access to it, and that may not be really what the business wants. So granting privileges to public is really not a recommended approach unless you really, really know what you are doing. Now, there is also the security is great, but you need to be able to manage it easily, or at least without not much pain. And when it comes to managing privileges in the database or in any other system for that matter, really doing these at the user level is very cumbersome. So if you have to grant all the privileges to the user at the user level, it means that there will be the management will be very of these privileges will be very difficult, particularly when you start talking about hundreds of users or even thousands of users. So instead of doing that, don't manage these privileges at the user level. Group your users into roles or into groups and grant privileges to roles. That's much easier. So then all you need to do after that is just changing the membership of users in the role. So for example, if somebody has moved from the role developer to the role architect or the role tester or whatever, you just move them from one role to another, and they could actually combine multiple roles if that's still valid. And because the roles are well defined, so generally if you have a role tester within an organization or a role developer, it's generally what they can or what they cannot do is generally well defined. So once you have established that, then the only thing that will be remaining is just moving people in and out of roles. Database connections. So in order to connect to a database today, you need to have a connect privilege on that particular database. There is one thing that you should be aware of is that when you create a database, historically, DB2 has been granting connect privilege to that database you just created to public. So this means anyone who has, for example, if the authentication is set to the operating system, anyone who has a valid user ID and password on that box on which DB2 installs could connect to your database. And that may or may not be what you really want, what you really intended. So there are really two things you could do here is, if the database is already there and connect is granted to public, you need to go and revoke it from public. And if you are creating a new database, then it's a good idea to actually use the restrict option, which will not cause DB2 to make these public grants. There is a sort of a similar concern when it comes to system catalog tables. So generally, catalog tables, they contain metadata. But in some situations, they actually can contain actual user data. So, for example, if you are familiar with the runstats command, the runstats captures statistics on tables, and some of these statistics are the high to key and low to key for a particular column. There is also the number of most frequent values and histograms for a particular column, and these are actual data. So, again, the default behavior when you create a database, DB2 will grant connect to public, but it will also grant select on the catalog to public. So if somebody has connected to the database and they can browse through the catalog, they may be able to see some data that you did not really intend for them to see. So here again, if you create your database with a restrict option, that will not happen. Or in the worst case, if the database is already there and the grant is there, go ahead and revoke that select from public and make sure that people have access, that the catalogs are accessed only on a need-to-know basis. There are other tables that often people do not pay too much attention to them. So for example, you have exception tables. So if you are familiar with the load command in DB2 or you're familiar with the set integrity, sometimes, you know, you load data and you say you have a constraint on the table or more than one constraint, and you want to make sure that rows that violate the constraint go actually to the exception table. So remember that, you know, after you have done your load and fixed all the things that you needed to fix, make sure that those exception tables, if they are not needed, get rid of them, or at least make sure that they are not open to public. Make sure that, you know, access to them is controlled. Similar things with MQTs. MQTs are very important tables when it comes to query optimization. But, you know, if you don't take proper care of how these things are, it could be also a security issue, in the sense, because you might have a table or a set of tables that are well protected. And, you know, if you create an MQT based on those tables, so what happens is that there is data from those tables that have actually flown and went to that MQT table. And if you don't make sure that that MQT is protected properly, then users who may not have access to data when it was on the base table may actually have access to data when it is in those MQT. So really the MQT is just, you know, is just, you know, meant to be a cache for DB2 to get quicker results back to you. So make sure that, you know, there is really no grants or no selects made on that MQT itself, unless, you know, you really know what you are doing. There is also the dynamic SQL versus static SQL issue. And so there is really a trade-off, and this is not just security. It also affects, you know, performance as well. But generally, when you are dealing with dynamic SQL, you really need to make sure that, you know, users and groups and roles, you know, have the privilege directly on the base object reference in that dynamic SQL. However, if this is static SQL, then only the person who will bind that package needs to have the authority, but users who will need to execute that package will not need to have the authority on those base objects. They just need to have execute on the package. So there is really a trade-off of how you want to do it here. And one thing to keep in mind is that when you have dynamic SQL, it's not just the performance and managing the privilege at the object level. It also can open issues that are not really database issues. They become application issues, because if you have application that is accepting input parameters and building dynamic SQL based on that, you could run into this issue that is referred to as SQL injection. So people could send you malformed SQL, and because the application does not do the proper checking, then, you know, people will be able to actually fool your application and make it return data that the end user is not authorized for. But again, this is not a database issue; it's an application issue. But it's important to be aware of. When you are discussing whether to go with dynamic SQL or with static SQL. Okay, so far we have been looking at what I would refer to as coarse grain authorization. Sometimes there is a requirement for fine grained authorization. So there can be a requirement of not just having select on the table, but I want to make sure that you have only. You could only select 5% or just 10 out of the 100 rows that are on the table. So this is what we refer to as row-level authorization. And if you are familiar with the label-based access control capability that we have added in 9.1, it offers a row-level access control capability based on security labels. And this is really important. It's based on security labels. So if you look at the example here, so we have a table that is called Articraft, and it has six rows. And the middle column there is actually the label column. So you have three rows that are unclassified. You have one top secret row. We have one secret row and one confidential row. And we have two users, Bob and Jane. Bob has an unclassified label, and Jane has a secret label. And they both issue that same SQL statement that you see there, the exact SQL statement. Because Bob is unclassified, his view of the table is only the three unclassified rows. The other rows are just non-existent as far as Bob is concerned. Jane, on the other hand, she has a secret label. So she can actually see more rows than what Bob can. In fact, she could see all the rows in the table except the last one, which is top secret. And that one does not exist as far as Jane is concerned. Now, I have mentioned the concept of a security label. And the security label is really what you use. It's what you use to tag your data. It could be a simple thing such as, you know, the example we have just seen, or, you know, a color you associate with the rows or a region. Or it can be a complex structure where you can have more than one component in the label. So one of the fundamental concepts of security labels is the concept of security label component. And security label component is, you know, the criteria you would like to use to design access control for your data. So for example, the example we have seen earlier, the unclassified confidential secret at top secret, for that one, if I wanted to implement it, I would use a security label component of type array. Because array, the values in an array, they imply an order. And so for example here, the order implied is highly sensitive is greater than sensitive, and sensitive is greater than confidential, and confidential is greater than public. If I want to say, you know, have access control based on colors, for example, I just want to color my rows, then for that one, I would probably use a set as opposed to an array, because a set does not have, you know, an order. And the third component that is supported is what we call a tree, and this is interesting in situations where you would like you have an organizational chart representing departments, for example, and you would like to associate departments with the data, meaning that, you know, this department owns this data, for example. So you could use labels made of any of these components or a combination of them. So we have seen security label components. So when you are designing, you're trying to come up with a design for your level authorization and security labels, you need to look at the component, but you also need to look at the rules that apply for the component, because that's very important. So for example, if you selected the array component, then you know that for reading, the rule that will be applied is the one that we call DB12 backread array. And this is basically saying that, like in the example we have seen earlier, you could see any value that is less than your value, but you cannot see values that are higher than yours. If you have selected the set, then the rule here basically says that you could see anything that your set dominates. So, for example, if you have colored your rows with blue, red, green, white, etc., so if you have the blue color, you could see all the blue rows, but if you have the blue and red, then you could see the blue and red rows. And if you have chosen the tree as a component, then you know that the rule that will be applied is the DB12 back read tree. And this basically says that, you know, you have access to the data as long as you have at least one of the elements in the tree associated with that data. There is also an inherent access built into tree in the sense that if a child has access to something, then so can a parent or an ancestor of that child. So that's with respect to the read rules. There are also write rules that come. And the write rules are the same as the read rules, except for one of them, which we need to look at into it very carefully, and this is the write rules when it comes to components of type array. So the idea here is that you could only write at your own level. So for example, if your level is secret, you cannot write either below or above secret. And if there is a reason for you to write outside of your level, you need to have additional privileges, and these are the things that we call exemptions. And remember that the LBAC model comes from the Department of Defense, and it's really primarily meant at intelligence and defense. So writing below your level is a very dangerous operation. This is what is referred to as a write-down, and it's really the classifying information. So it's something that is very tightly controlled. So I mentioned the exemption. So you could, you know, if somebody has a requirement to, you know, bypass certain rules, you need to grant them certain exemptions. So for example, if somebody wants to write below their level, you would grant them the DB12 back write array for write down. So this is a question that I always get, and it's when to use LBAC for row level authorization. I would answer this as follows. If you are dealing with a government application that deals with classified information, like intelligence or defense, there is very, very, very high probability that LBAC is a fit for row-level authorization. And it's almost going to be the array component that we have seen earlier. However, if you are not dealing with a government applications from the intelligence or the defense community, then you need to be... You need to keep in mind that LBAC is not a general solution for all row and column level access control problems. It's really, as I mentioned earlier, it's a solution really that comes where the specification and requirements come from the intelligence and defense community. So if you are familiar with the multi-level security solution on DB2 for ZWS, this is its equivalent. If you are familiar with the Oracle label security, this is its equivalent. And if you look at all these solutions that I just mentioned, they, you will find that they are primarily used in the intelligence and defense community. They are almost not used or rarely used outside of that community. So, however, we believe that the LBAC implementation that we have in DB2 for LUW has some flexibility in it that might allow to meet certain requirements even outside the intelligence and defense. But in order for you to be sure that it meets those requirements, you need, you know, to ask these questions. Is the data classification known? Because if the data classification is not known, it's very hard to imagine the security labels, because data classification is not known. Let's say the data classification is known. Then you need to see whether the classification can actually be represented by the security label component that we have seen. If they can, then that's great. Then you have to look at the authorization rules that, you know, this application you are looking at or this customer requirements you are looking at, and you ask yourself, do these rules or can these rules be mapped to the label component rules that we have seen earlier? If they are, then that's great, and then you have actually found a fit. And we have actually found some fit outside of the intelligence and defense community. However, if none of the above is not possible, then you need to look at some other approaches for your row-level authorization. For example, views are probably a better alternative here. So it's really very important to understand when and when not to use LBAC. So, as I mentioned earlier, LBAC offers row-level authorization, but it also offers column-level authorization. So, the idea here, if you have a column that is very sensitive and you want to make sure that only people who are authorized to access that column can actually access the column. You could use LBAC to associate a label with that column. And once you have associated the label with that column, then only users who have security labels or exemptions that allow them to see that column, they will see it. Otherwise, they will not. And this is very important because even if you are database administrator or you are system administrator or the table owner, you cannot bypass that control. So this is very important. So for example, if you want to protect information from access by high-level, high-privileged users such as the database administrator or the system administrator, and that's one way to do it. So the other question that I get is when to use LBAC for column-level authorization. So there are two reasons you would want to use it. So the first one is what I mentioned earlier, is you just want to control access to a sensitive column, such as social security number or credit card number, etc. And the other reason you may want to use column-level authorization is if you have a table that is sensitive and you just want to make sure that your DB item does not have access to that table. So today, the only way to do that in DB2, really, and you know, make sure that DBM does not have access to that, to the data in there, is to assign a security label to the columns in that table, assign that security label to a role, and assign that role to all the users who need access to the table. Once you have done that, then no one will have any access to the table unless they are a member of that role. And this is really a very neat way of controlling access to database administrators. Okay, another access control capability that exists in DB2 is what we call trusted context. So trusted context actually is after addressing two key problems, and these two problems are really independent of each other. So the first one is the problem of using a single user ID by mid-tier applications to access the database. And this security model is actually very bad because from the database perspective, everybody appears to be as that single ID. So when you look at access control and auditing, if you don't really know the users, you have basically made access control and auditing useless. Because if everybody is Bob, then what's the purpose of access control and auditing? So there was a need for a capability that would allow a mid-tier application to assert the end-user identity to the database so that it is that end-user identity that is used for access control and auditing. The second problem is that trusted contexts are addressing is the absence of a way to control when a user could take advantage of a privilege. So, for example, I want to make sure that my DBA could only exercise their DBA abilities only when they are accessing the database from a certain IP address. So before 9.5, you could not do that. In 9.5, starting with trusted context, you could do that. So the key point here is that you could use trusted context for either of these two problems, or both. So what is a trusted context? So a trusted context is really a specification for a trust relationship. And this trust relationship is between the database and between something else such as an application. And the trust relationship is based on three attributes. There is the connection authorization ID, there is the IP address from which that connection is coming from, and there is the data stream encryption, whether or not the flow of data between the application and the database is encrypted or not. So a trusted connection, a connection that meets the definition of a particular trust relationship will be referred to as a trusted connection. So for example, this is how you would specify a trust relationship. So you create a trusted context and you say the system auth ID is app server ID, the attributes, you provide those two addresses and you set encryption to high. Encryption to high means SSL. So this means if there is a connection that comes from the user called UpserverID, and it comes from either of those two addresses, and the communication between the database and that application is using SSL, then that connection will be referred to as a trusted connection, because it meets the definition of that trust relationship that you see there. So, now we talked about trusted connection. So what's the big deal about trusted connection? Well, trusted connection actually provide you capabilities that you cannot, that may not be available to you outside the scope of that trusted connection. So they could allow you to, the ability to switch the current user on a connection. So for example, if you are a mid-tier application, you would establish a trust connection, and then before issuing SQL or statements on behalf of your end users, you would actually use the switch user capability of trusted context to pass the ID of the end user to the database, so that your SQL that you will send later will actually be authorized and audited according to that end user. And the trusted connection could also acquire conditional privileges that may not be available to it outside the scope of that trusted connection. This is the second problem that trust connects are addressing. So for example, here we have defined the trust relationship, and what you see in blue here is the with respect, that's how you control the switching of user. So for example, here what it is saying is once the trusted connection has been established, then UpserverID can actually switch to any user without even having to give an authentication token. However, the requirement is saying that if you try to switch to Alice, you need to provide an authentication token. This is an example of a specification for a conditional role. So, for example, let's say you have a user, and that user needs to be granted the database administrator authority. But you don't want really to grant it to the user directly, or to a role in which they are a member, or to a group in which they are a member, because you want to associate some condition with as to when they could exercise that role. So this is how you would do it. So you create a role, you call it DBA, you grant DBA item to that role, DBA, and then you create a trusted context, and you specify that blue clause that you see there, default role DBA. So that means that the user, Jay Levy, would only be able to exercise their DBA authority only when they are coming from a connection that meets those requirements. Otherwise, they will not have access to that DBA role.
Walid, okay. Can we pause for a question on the section
on the access control? Yes, I was about to suggest that, because we are going to move into encryption now.
Okay. Hey, Marjorie, can you open the lines for a question and answer, please?
Thank you, sir. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please press star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. And once again, if you would like to ask a question, that is star 1 on your telephone keypad. We will pause for just a moment. We have no questions at this time. I'll turn the call back to our speakers.
Okay. So remember in the beginning that we said the three pillars of database security are access control, encryption, and auditing. So we have covered access control, and we have looked at all the capabilities that are available in 9.5. Now we are going to look at encryption. And encryption, there are really two use cases for encryption. You would use encryption for encrypting the flow of communication between the DB2 client and the DB2 server, or you would want to use encryption for encrypting the data as it is stored on disk. So in one case, in the first case, you are really concerned about people, you know, sniffing your network and, you know, getting access to your data. In the second case, you are actually concerned about people going to the data that resides on disk and either steal the disk or use, you know, some privileged users to actually get to your data. So there are two different threats. So data in transit encryption. So we have currently DB2 recommends to use SSL, secure socket layer, for any data in transit encryption requirement. So why we are recommending SSL? Since A2, we had an option called data encrypt, which actually does encrypt the communication between the client and the server. Unfortunately, this uses an old technology. It uses DES as the encryption algorithm, and it uses 56-bit encryption key. DES, as most of you probably know already, is no longer the industry standard for doing encryption. Most auditors would require your solution to be using AES, which is the new standard. The other important thing to keep in mind here is SSL provides not only encryption, but it also provides data integrity. So the data encrypt solution that we have just provides encryption. SSL provides data integrity in the sense that if you are sending encrypted stream of data and somebody, you know, before it reaches the server, somebody alters that in some way, DB2 or the SSL implementation in DB2 will be able to find that out and alert you. With the previous technology, you will not be able to find that out, so it will decrypt to something that was not really intended. And also, if you are dealing with a federal government customer, they will probably ask for FIPS compliance. And the good thing about the SSL implementation in DB2 is that it is FIPS compliant. So how does DB2 SSL works? So SSL is a client-server architecture, as you know. So on the server side, the SSL implementation comes from a product that we call Gskit. It's actually a Tivoli product that DB2 works with, and that's really what provides the actual SSL implementation. So if you are a client such as JCC, you don't really need Gskit because JCC has already its own SSL implementation, and it's what is referred to as JSSE. So if you are JCC, you are a JCC application, and a Java application, you don't really need to install anything on your client side. You just need to make sure that DB2 is configured to talk to you with SSL, and the Gskit product is there. So you probably know that SSL works based on digital certificates. So on the server side, there needs to be a digital certificate database which will contain the digital certificate for the server. So this is like, you know, the ID card for the server that basically identifies that server to the rest of the world. And you also need to have on your client side signer certificate database. So this is a database of certificates you trust. Because really that's how SSL works. It works based on digital certificate. So the way it works is that once the client issues, you know, tries to establish a session with the server will respond with its digital certificate. And the client will look at that digital certificate and compare and see who signed it and compare that to the signers that it trusts. And if this happens to be that it is signed by one of the signers it trusts, then the communication will continue. Otherwise, the communication will not be allowed. And in the case where the communication needs to continue, the client and the server will negotiate an encryption algorithm, and they will also negotiate an encryption key for that session. And once they have reached an agreement on what that encryption algorithm is and on what that encryption key is, then they can start exchanging data, and that data will be encrypted and decrypted using that algorithm and that key they agreed upon. The key thing to point out is that as of today, the only type of clients that can actually take advantage of the SSL capability are Java clients, JCC clients. Other clients like CLI and such will be coming in the next fix packs, I believe. So this is what I just talked about. Okay, so let's spend a couple of minutes on how you want to configure this. So you need to configure your certificates databases, and this happens to be on the client and on the server. The Gzkit product that I mentioned earlier comes with a tool called iKeyman, which is a GUI tool, which allows you to create certificate database and allows you to import a digital certificate that you could have purchased from your from some certificate authority into that database. And you could do the same thing on the client side as well. So you create your signer certificate database and you could import the public keys of the certificate authorities you trust. So there is a certificate database configuration step. And then there is a server configuration. So here I'm talking about 9.5, and the following release is going to be much, much easier. So in 9.5, what you need to do is you need to create an SSL configuration file, and you need to store in that configuration file three key informations. One of them, for example, is the port number for the SSL listener. This is where DB2 will listen to SSL connections. And finally, you need also to enable the DB2 for SSL communication, and you basically need to set the DB2COM registry variable to SSL, or you could have set it to TCP, IP, and SSL together. So that's the server configuration. So we have seen the certificate configuration on the client on the server. This is the server configuration. And the client configuration, basically, you need in your Java application, you need to identify... you need to tell the system that you are interested in a SSL connection. So just by setting that attribute and setting true for it, you need to identify where the this is called the trust store. So this is basically your certificate, your signer certificate database, and the password for that application to access that signer certificate database. So just you need to make sure that your application has these three things, and as long as the server is configured to talk SSL, then you are pretty much set. So that's with respect to data encryption in transit. So the key thing to remember is use SSL. Now with respect to data in storage. This is going to be a little longer than data in transit. So why would you want to encrypt data in storage? Sometimes the answer is very easy. You don't need to argue with it. It's just you must do so. So some regulations such as PCI tells you must encrypt the data when it sits on disk. That's very easy. When it is not as crystal clear as the first bullet, then this is where you start into why you want to do encryption. And it's really useful in the cases where you want to protect against unauthorized access to the data that happens outside the scope of the database. It's the database cannot help you there because the access is outside the scope of the database. So, for example, someone with sysadm authority or with enough privileges actually goes after the files that implement your tablespace containers and therefore implement your data. So somebody is browsing the file directly. DB2 cannot do anything about them, or any database for that matter. Or somebody is just taking a backup tape from the shelf. There is really no technology that can protect about that because it's outside the database scope. So in this case, when the data is protected, it's very useful because unless you have the keys to decrypt that data is useless to you, even if you steal it. Now, this is a very important distinction because I have seen this confusion many times. Access control and encryption. You should never confuse access control with encryption. So I have seen many emails such as, I have a column that, you know, I want to protect against the DBA access and I would like to encrypt it. I don't view this as an encryption problem. I view this as an access control problem. If you have a column that you want to protect from the DBA access or from anyone's access, you need to use the access control capabilities for that. It's not an encryption problem. So it's very important not to confuse access control and encryption. So there are really two schools of thought when it comes to how you implement how you implement encryption in the database. There is one school of thought which says provide a way for customers to encrypt a particular column in a table. And we in DB2, in fact, had gone in that road since version 7, I believe. We had SQL built-in functions that allow you to encrypt data in columns that you have chosen. And the second school of thought basically says, don't use column level, rather encrypt data at the file level. And, you know, there has been lots of debate on why one versus the other. We in DB2, after having implemented the column-level encryption and having seen what implication it has when it comes to performance and when it comes to transparency and when it comes to key management, we realized that file-level encryption is actually a better approach. If you have heard of the IBM database encryption product, that's a file-level encryption solution that we currently recommend as our strategic encryption solution. Obviously, this database encryption solution is something that the customer needs to purchase and pay for, so, you know, there is a cost associated with that. There is also a somewhat equivalent solution that the customer can actually get for free. So if your customer is using AIX 6.1 and they are not a DPF DB2 configuration, then they could actually configure AIX to encrypt the files pretty much in the same way that the database encryption expert does. The GUIs and interfaces would be different, but the actual principles and technology are the same, so encrypting a file as data is written and read from that file. So that's another option. So, for example, if the customer is reluctant to buy and purchase an additional product and, you know, they happen to be on AIX 6.1, this is something that you could recommend to them. So this is just very quickly want to go through the discussion about the two schools of thought. So there is the transparency issue. So if you are implementing column-level encryption, you will realize that column-level encryption is highly invasive to the database schema and database designs, and it's not transparent to the application, so you have to go and change your application so that you have the encrypt and decrypt call in there. However, file-level encryption really happens, you know, at the file level, and it's not only transparent to the to the application, it's also transparent to DB2 itself. And the other interesting thing here is the scope. So if the goal is really to just encrypt the sensitive data in a particular table, then quite frankly, whether you do it with column level or you do it with file level, it's pretty much the same. The data that will be sitting in disk, it will be encrypted and you are safe. However, something that people often forget is that data moves. Data exists in a variety of places. So, for example, you have data in transaction logs. You have data in export files sitting on your file, on your operating system files. For these places where the data resides, the database quantum level encryption solution doesn't really help you because, you know, encrypting those objects is outside its scope. However, if you opted for a file level encryption solution, then you could actually leverage that to even encrypt things like, you know, your export files or your transaction logs, and you have a better overall solution because you are dealing with copies of the data that happen to exist somewhere else outside the scope of your database. Key management. This is really the most important thing about encryption. So, encryption, there are two components to encryption. There is the actual encryption algorithm, and there is the keys that are used for encryption and decryption. And the algorithms, you know, are generally public and well known. What is really important is key management, is how you protect the keys. Because if somebody managed to have access to the keys that were used to encrypt your data, then you might as well not bother with encrypting the data. So when it comes to key management, the database encryption expert solution that we have actually provides very good ways for centrally managing and storing your keys. If you opt for the column level encryption, you will probably end up having to manage your own keys, and that's really, you know, in the long term, going to be a nightmare. Finally, performance. So when we are looking at column level and file level encryption, we have realized that on average, column level encryption adds an overhead of about 40% to 50%. And this is not really because cryptography is bad, but it's really because of the manner in which column level encryption inserts itself in the database. For example, you know, the indexing effectiveness is diminished, particularly for range queries, because, you know, when you encrypt the data, the order is no longer preserved. So the data needs to be decrypted in order to evaluate range predicates such as, you know, A greater than 5 or A between 7 and 15 and things like that. The file level encryption, because it happens, you know, as data is read and written to the file, has a much, much better performance. So the overhead there that we measured was in the 5% range, which is way better than the column level encryption that we have. So I'm not going to spend too much time on the database encryption expert because I know that this has hammered so many times through different presentations from different people. So the key thing, I think if there is one key thing to remember, two key things to remember actually when it comes to encryption for data in storage. The first one is that we recommend file-level encryption as opposed to column-level encryption. And there are two options for file-level encryption. There is the IBM Database Encryption Expert product that you need to purchase, and it supports multiple platforms. Or if you are on AAX 6.1 and you are not a DPS, you could actually do pretty much the same thing with AAX, and it's for free. So I'm going to skip these details about the encryption expert. Okay, so I'm about to start the third pillar of database security, and it's auditing. And maybe we can stop for some question on the previous pillar if there are any. Operator?
Thank you. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, that is star one if you'd like to ask a question. And we have no questions at this time. I'll turn the call back to our speakers.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so the third pillar of database security is auditing. So, why auditing? Sometimes it's very easy to answer. You must audit. So, for example, if you look at the PCI standard, there are requirements in there where you must audit. if you look at the California State Senate bill, you will find out that there are requirements that you must audit as well. So these are what I call the easy answers, because you don't need to do any philosophical debate on it. SOX requires you to audit. HIPAA requires you to audit. There are also similar regulations in other countries that also require you to audit. So that's sort of the easy part. Now, this is where you can become philosophical. So it's a good idea to audit business users because they have access to very sensitive private and corporate data. So it's generally good business to make sure that these business users are audited to see what they are doing with the data. IT users. So IT users generally are managing your IT, and as such, you know, they have full access to your systems, your production systems. So it's also generally a good practice to make sure that these IT users are auditing to see what they might be doing with your data. We have talked earlier about the insider threat. It's always a good practice to audit sensitive data, whether, you know, regardless of who's using it. If the data is sensitive, put policies around it for auditing it. Also, it's also a good idea to audit sensitive applications. You know, you have, you know, financial transactions, medical history, and HR transactions. So these are dealing with important information. It's also good practice for auditing. So like I said, there is the first part where it's very easy. The answer is very easy. There is a regulation that says you must audit. And then there is this set of sort of common sense and best practices. So in DB2, we have an audit facility that can generate audit records for a series of predefined events. So when you look at the audit record, you can have some insight into who did what, where, and how. The audit records themselves are stored in an audit file, and this audit file is actually configurable. So previously, and before 9.5, it was not configurable, but in 9.5, you could actually configure where that audit information goes. There are two forms of auditing. The first one is what I would like to refer to as our historical auditing. So we used to have audit at the instance level. It used to be such that when you turn it on, it applies for the entire instance, meaning any database inside that instance will have that audit setting applied to. This has been very challenging to actually implement in production environment because it has huge overhead and it's not configurable because it does not have fine granularity. In 9.5, this is really where we have made the most substantial audit enhancements since many, many, many years. We have introduced database-level auditing. This is really where you have the fine granularity so that you can have good performance in production environments. It's totally independent from instance-level auditing. It's configured using audit policies, and audit policies are created using SQL, so you have SQL statement for granting, config for creating and altering audit policies, and there is also an audit SQL statement that allows you to associate policies with objects or entities you would like to audit. And it is under the exclusive control of the security administrator. So there is a set of predefined audit category that you could choose when you are creating your audit policies. So if you choose the audit category, then this means that whenever there are changes to the audit settings themselves, there will be audit record generated. If you choose the checking category, then there will be a record generated each time DB2 does an authorization check. The execute category is the new category that we have added in 9.5, and it's really meant to show the execution of SQL statements. The main category would generate records whenever objects are created or dropped, like if you create a table or create some sort of object. And the segment category, security maintenance, would generate records for security-related operations, such as your grants and revokes. And the validate category would generate records whenever users are being authenticated or their group information is being retrieved. So you don't have to use all of them. You have to look at what makes sense and select that category when you are creating your audit policies. The last two are the sysadmin category, which would generate records whenever operations requiring either of the high-level authorities are being performed. And finally, the context category generates records to show the context of a particular operation. So this is really what I would like to call the cool stuff. So this is what we added in 9.5. So we added the concept of audit policies. So you could create an audit policy. Like in this example, you are creating an audit policy. You are calling it sensitive data policy. And you said you are interested in the ops maintenance category and the security maintenance category. Now, okay, you have created your audit policy. Now, you could actually associate those audit policies with a number of database objects. So you could create an audit policy for the database as a whole and you associate it with the database. You'd create an audit policy and you could associate it with a table or two tables or n tables. You could create an audit policy and you could associate it with some authorities like your database administrator or your security administrator or your system administrator. Or you could associate it with users or groups or roles, or you could also associate it with a trusted context. So for example, you have an application that is sensitive coming through a trusted context and you want anything inside that trusted context to be audited. So the key thing here is that the audit policy concept allows you to only select what makes most sense to you to audit. And this is a big difference from the pre-9.5 DB2 where you did not have that granularity and you have a huge performance overhead because of that. Now in 9.5, this fine granularity allows you actually to address that problem. So you could only audit what makes sense to you. So like I mentioned earlier, you could use the audit SQL statement to associate a policy with an object. So for example here, I'm saying audit authority DBAdm role marketing, role accounting, role support using policy sensitive data policy. So I created that policy called sensitive data policy earlier, and now I'm saying I'm going to audit the DBAdm, anyone who has DBAdm, anyone who is a member of the roles marketing, accounting, support using this policy. So anyone that meets those criteria will be audited according to that policy. Okay, so like I said, so you could use the audit SQL statement to associate policies with entities or objects. So if you select the database, then anything within the scope of a connection to that database will be audited according to the policy that you have associated with the database. You could also associate a policy with a table, and that will basically audit any SQL execution on that table. So there are some sorts of tables that are not supported. So for example, typed tables are not supported. You could also associate an audit policy with any of the predefined authorities. So these are the sysadm, dbadm, secadm, syscontrol, sysmain, sysmon. So you could have a policy with any of these authorities, meaning that anyone who has that authority will be audited according to the policy that you have selected for them. You could audit specific users, specific groups, or specific roles. And as I said, you could also audit trusted contexts. So to summarize, if you are looking at an audit solution, you need to determine what audit event you want to capture. So you need to look at the categories that we have seen earlier and select the ones that make sense to you or to your requirements, rather. And then you have to define audit policies that capture those audit events. And then you need to associate those audit policies with who or what you would like to be audited. Is it users, tables, trusted contacts, etc.? And you need to periodically you need to periodically archive your active audit log, and you extract that archived audit log into a text file, and you could load that text file into your database tables and use the power of SQL to analyze your audit trail. So here, let me just clarify a bit. I combined two things here. So I combined the configuration and setting up of the audit, but one important thing is that if you just do the auditing and you never look at the data you are auditing, then you might as well have not bothered with auditing. So here what I did is I combined the two, so the configuration and the setting of the auditing, and then the suggestion is that you need to start looking at that auditing. So there are two ways of looking at the audit. You can turn that active audit into a text file and look at it, you know, just visually and see if anything looks suspicious. But generally, this is a large file and it's very, very hard to actually look and find anything. So what I am suggesting here is that load it into tables and then use SQL to figure out, you know, if anything is suspicious. So for example, you could load it into table and then write an SQL statement that selects, you know, if and see if Bob has been rejected three times when he tried to connect. And you know, it's that sort of analysis. So this, there are two steps here. Configure your audit. Make sure that you are auditing according to the business requirements by setting those policies and associating those policies with what needs to be audited. And then you must have, you know, a sort of a procedure of how to look into this data you are collecting and look for suspicious behaviors. And that's my last chart. Operator, we probably can open for questions now.
As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, that is star one if you'd like to ask a question. We'll pause for a moment. Our first question comes from Robert Beal. Oh, I apologize. He did disconnect. Again, as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, that is star one if you'd like to ask a question. And we have no questions at this time. I'll turn the call back to our speakers for any additional or closing remarks.
Thank you. I just want to thank, you know, Taboo and everyone for organizing this session.
Okay. Thanks, Waleed. And once again, if you have any other questions, you may send me the questions, or you can send the questions to Waleed Rajaibi, and we're more than happy to answer those questions. All right. Have a great day, and we'll talk to you on the next deep dive. Thank you, Waleed.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Marjorie.
Thank you, and ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference. We appreciate your participation, and have a wonderful day.
Waleed, can you pass me the presenter mode?
Okay, how do I do that? I do sign out?
Just right-click on my name and say make presenter.
Okay. Make presenter. Okay, I've done that.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, I got it. Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, thanks, bye.